This conference will now be recorded.
Welcome to today's Performance Management Group call on population health. Terry Hill, the Senior Advisor for Rural Health Leadership and Policy at the National Rural Health Resource Center in Duluth, Minnesota, is going to be facilitating today's call. So I'll turn it over to Terry to start introductions.
Okay, thank you very much, Leslie. The topic of the day is population health. And this is a topic that has growing interest across the United States. It's relatively broad in scope. We're going to try to narrow it down a bit. We're going to talk about what does population health have to do with rural hospitals and the folks that work there. We're going to hear from one of our state rural health leaders, Pat Scow, who is the executive director of the Illinois Critical Access Hospital Network. And Pat and the ICANN, which includes, what is it, about 53 rural hospitals, critical access hospitals in Illinois,
have been working
on a significant new project where they're developing a population health coordinated care, accountable care type of organization. And we're going to hear a little bit more from Pat. This is a huge development. In essence, what we see is that the healthcare industry is moving very rapidly towards more of this population health sort of a payment model. And we talk here at the center, and others folks talk about rural hospitals and the folks that lead them kind of moving from this current reimbursement system, which is based on getting paid for individual patients, to the new system, which is part of the Affordable Care Act, but larger than the Affordable Care Act. That's one of the things I really want to stress here. This is not just about the Affordable Care Act. It is about the healthcare market in general, and at least we here at the center and almost everybody I talk to concludes that the change is absolutely going to happen, and that what's going to be really important is that rural hospitals prepare for the new system, which is going to come in and be phased in over the next number of years. So right now, what we have across the country is over, I think, over right now, the last I saw, somewhere between 500 and 600 accountable care organizations, which basically are kind of founded on this population health concept. And so we're going to talk to Pat about the plans from the Illinois Critical Access Hospital Network and have kind of this broader discussion to begin with. We're then going to zero in terms of what does population health mean to our individual hospitals, particularly those of us that are here in the Delta region. And in that regard, we have Evelyn Ormond, who's the CEO of Union General Hospital in Farmerville, Louisiana, Diane Davidson, who's a division leader and director of administrative services at Union General Hospital, and Claudia Wade, who is an executive assistant and grant writer at Union General Hospital, who are going to talk about the projects that they implemented, the good work that they've been doing in their community, and talk about our rural hospital performance improvement project, consulting experience, and kind of what the outcomes were in their experiences, et cetera. So I'm really looking forward to the conversation and learning more here as we start broad, as I mentioned, and then move into somewhat of a greater discussion about what this means on the community level. So with that, and having made those introductions, these are outstanding people and outstanding leaders. I won't go into a whole lot more detail about that, but I want to turn first to the question about what are the challenges that are facing rural hospitals now, kind of in regard to this movement into value-based payment systems, population health, and how are hospitals preparing for the future? So, Pat, I'm going to Pat Scow, I'm going to ask you to lead off by talking about What was it that compelled so many of your hospitals to be interested in developing this new model of care and the new model of reimbursement?
Okay, thank you, Terry. I appreciate the opportunity to be part of this discussion, and I think it's an exciting time, a little scary, but exciting time for all of us, and I guess we decided that the glass was half full instead of half empty, you know, with the changes with the Affordable Care Act, and we know that we could not sustain the type of healthcare system that we had. I mean, there's a lot of good things about our healthcare system. You know, we've all been in the hospital business or clinic business or whatever for years. But we know that it very much needed to change. So, as you know, I work with our critical access hospitals and also manage the Flex and the SHIP program. And one of our projects last year was to look at, you know, what we might be able to do is for population health, knowing that the hospitals are facing things and asking the same question that Terry just did there, because, you know, the hospitals are saying, hey, we know we need to move. We have no money. We don't know. You know, we're doing some things, but we're not doing a lot. Our physicians really are clueless to the most part of it. Some of them are reporting their quality data. Some of them aren't. Our boards really, you know, are back in the volume-based mode. You know, they're really focused on finance. It was a tremendous step getting them orientated to quality, let alone moving them to population health management. And so we felt we needed to have some talking points. So we put together a work group last summer of several CEOs, and we really explored what would be the challenges the hospitals would have to take, and really did kind of an inventory and realized that a number of hospitals have been working on it. And the fact that they all have employee health programs, and some have even started to tie their risk management to premiums and offered some case management, a lot of incentive programs for wellness. And many of them have been targeting, you know, local health departments, you know, working walking trails and cancer care programs and really, you know, beginning to do into that. But what was interesting about when we brought the group together and doing this inventory and preparing a paper that, you know, you have to have some talking points. And that was what I think Terry and his staff of the Managing Healthy Communities in Rural Illinois was just to get this conversation started. One of the things ICANN has done is we provide community health needs assessments. And so, you know, that partly led to our discussion there, noting that, you know, 5-10 years ago, you would have not have thought wellness would be a top priority. But when we did our community needs assessment with 28 hospitals, wellness was either the top 1, 2, or 3. So going down that path, participating in this study and trying to figure out what options that we had for rural, all of a sudden we realized that, hey, you know, maybe as a group we needed to work together to share resources. So, you know, as far as what our hospitals doing, they're trying to do an inventory, trying to see who are in their community, are good partners, and can we do some things together, and really kind of where we are today. And I can talk more about that, but I thought you may want to add to that, Terry. I just kind of gave you an overview of where we were.
Yeah, thanks, Pat. You know, the American Hospital Association said, and this was in 2007, this is before the Affordable Care Act. We have a quote here I wanted to share with you from the American Hospital Association. It says, it's no longer about what we charge for hospital visits, but what it costs to keep an insured population healthy. We just talked, now that is about as good a definition of population health as we have here. It's really about keeping people healthy. That may sound a little scary because we've been making our business about, making money off of people, you know, that get sick, that we take care of, et cetera. So first, you have to acknowledge that what we're talking about here is not a tweaking the system. It's not, you know, small changes this year. This is as dramatic a change as we can ever envision. And the other thing that I'd like to talk just a little bit about at this particular point, and I also invite, you know, is it Evelyn?
Yep.
For Evelyn to jump in if she has a comment on this as well. But my understanding is that the Louisiana Hospital Association did a survey of the hospitals in Louisiana. These are the rural hospitals, I believe. And the number one priority the number one thing they were most concerned about was their boards of directors, which I've never seen anything like that. This is relatively recent because, in essence, as you all know, we have boards of directors made up of local citizens, and what we're talking about here is a very somewhat complex idea about payment systems, et cetera. So it takes a little bit of understanding kind of moving forward in that regard. So, Pat, let me ask you, are your hospitals in Illinois experiencing any pushback or any real concerns on the part of your and the boards of directors?
And I think that's really a very good point. Not really, because I think we've had four different governing board retreats in different parts of the state where we brought physicians and board members and CEOs together to talk about it. It's not really the pushback. It's just the uncertainty. They realize that this is the way the hospital needs to go. But what we can't figure out, and this is what's keeping the CFOs figuring out, is that how do we live under, you know, population health when we're all in a, you know, a different reimbursement system, and how do we live under the high deductibles and, you know, out of not high deductibles and the total out of pocket cost. And so the board members are saying, we know we need to do this, but somebody have a strategy. And I think what Terry's getting at is that nobody has a strategy. So if the boards are very much engaged, they want hospitals to help lead them and to educate them, because they realize what they traditionally did in coming to hospital board meetings, approving construction projects and all sorts of stuff. And even quality was a challenge, but this is even more so because the balance sheets will start to look different.
Yeah, and Evelyn, I wonder if you could weigh in on this. Obviously, you've done some really terrific work in your community itself. Did you have initial support from the board? Do they understand the need to work closer with the community? Do you feel they kind of understand why you're doing this community work?
Yeah, we have an exceptional board of directors. They are made up of local leaders in our community. They do not take that job lightly. They're constantly being educated on any new theory or new words or just whatever the healthcare brings nowadays. We even have a very devoted president that will attend conferences out of state with us. So he's very much engaged. I've just been very fortunate in the 22 years I've been here that the board is whatever we need to do for our hospital is what we're going to do. So, you know, I think it's very, very important that you have a board that wants to work together as a team, not have a board of leaders on it that have different agendas. You have to all be on the same page. And we've been very fortunate to have had that here. Go ahead.
I was going to mention, thanks, Evelyn. It's the board of directors is crucially important here. And one of the things we're doing here at the center, well, let me just describe something we did in March, is we brought a group of leaders together, people including Pat Scow came, but there were quite a number of people who represented rural hospitals, represented state rural hospital programs, hospital associations. We had some public health representatives, and we had two physicians in this summit meeting, one from Harvard Medical School and another one who had been working at Mayo. And basically, we really tried to zero in as what can we tell rural hospitals? What can this group tell rural hospitals about where to begin and what to be thinking about moving forward here? I don't really want to be overly dramatic, but from an organizational standpoint, we're really talking about kind of life and death here from a hospital standpoint. We're very, very concerned that the market and the changes taking place not leave our rural hospitals behind. And there are all too many people out there who basically say, you know, they either sink or they swim. If they're not there, we'll have to come up with something else later. Kind of this issue of population health is about as important as anything that we here at the center have been dealing with for a long time. Now, what did the folks say? What we've come up with a report and some specific recommendations, and kind of at the top of that list, as we've already discussed, is the boards of directors. That in essence, the boards have got to be, they've got to understand that the Affordable Care Act is not the primary motivation for this. I just told you in 2007, it was the American Hospital Association saying we were going to come to this as well. In essence, the market itself is moving. It's the Mayo Clinics of the world, and every big tertiary care center, I can pretty much guarantee you out there, is moving in this direction. And we really hope, and there's no plans to end critical access hospital funding, for example, but it's very clear to us that hospitals in general are going to have to play some role in this. And so the boards have got to understand as well. Another really crucial aspect here has to do with the physicians. And I'm going to ask both Pat and Evelyn to talk a little bit about that. Maybe, Pat, you going first. I think you've already referred to this, Pat, but it is this concept that we're going to need to form new partnerships or strong partnerships with our physicians, and I wonder if you could expound upon that a little more.
Sure, that's really key. This is the first time I've seen in a long time where the hospitals and the physicians have to realize that they're in this together. You know, they kind of went their separate ways years ago. The physicians did their thing, the hospitals did their thing, but it can't happen anymore. And for rural to be successful, and that's our forte is primary care and emergency service and things like that, we have to come together because that's the role we play. But I think when you talk to the physicians, one of the things, and Evelyn will probably talk about is the sense of urgencies. Physicians, you typically have naysayers with them. So, we had the HMOs and all this stuff, and yeah, you know, how am I going to get my patients to be compliant, and do I really have to do this? Well, I can give you an example in my own particular town here is that we had a physician group that very independent for years, wonderful group of folks, but they decided they weren't going to do electronic medical records, and they weren't going to submit their quality data. Well, all of a sudden, lo and behold, now they're facing in their practice, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars of deficit. And so quickly, they've now turned to the local hospital and one retired. So, you know, I think the physicians have to realize that this is a sense of urgency and to really be part of the solution and realize that they can continue to provide good care. We're just going to provide a different support system.
You have an excellent story there where yours turned out where the doctor turned around. I can't really say that I have that yet. I have one that is on board and one that is already starting to take the hit and has no intentions of coming around. So that does make a huge issue for us. One of the things that we have found is by employing the physicians, those people are definitely on board. You know, the doctors that are coming out of school nowadays want to be employed and understand what you have to do. You know, they don't have a set agenda that's been ingrained in them for years. I mean, they understand whatever we have to take and do is you know, is what how they're going to build their practice. So, you know, I think the biggest part that I could give is that employ your physicians because they seem to get on board a lot quicker and understand. They come from med school understanding the changes already. So independents are still difficult to deal with in rural America.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Evelyn. And in essence, the other thing we've got to be very careful about is that primary care physicians in this new model are going to be of ultimate value. They become more important than the surgeons. They become they're kind of the people that the folks that kind of are helping to manage the care, to coordinate the care, to be truly the gatekeepers here as well. So what we're going to see is the demand for primary care physicians is going to increase. It's probably going to get tougher to recruit them, and it makes a whole lot more sense to try to partner with them now, do whatever we can to keep them in our rural communities, because they're going to be difficult to acquire. And in the formula, and again, we're talking reimbursement here, the primary care physicians are going to be the drivers of the new reimbursement model. I mean, they already were in the old model, but in the new model, even more so in that regard. So that's an important piece. Another piece has to do with, okay, if we're going to get paid now to keep our community healthy, or let's say our Medicare patient, let me just talk about this. There's two kinds of population health. One of them has to do with a large, maybe the whole community, for example, or it's a large population that it's kind of traditionally been the responsibility of public health providers in that regard. And so that's one model that's out there. But another way to look at it is take all the people who have diabetes in your service area, and they become another population as well, or all of your Medicare patients. In Oregon, for example, all the hospitals, rural and urban, are now in this system for their Medicaid patients. In other words, they are responsible for the total cost of the care of that group of Medicaid patients in their service area. So what hospitals are going to need to do, and we've got a great example of this, a Union General Hospital already starting to do this, is they're going to have to find ways to keep people healthy, because that's the success formula. That's the ultimate goal. Besides taking care of people when we need to, there's also big high quality standards that you have to meet too. So you can't get away with under-treating in this new model. So as we talk about, you know, we're not really generally wellness centers. So how can we change to become wellness centers? And that's kind of going to be the example that we're going to provide here on this call. But another thing that our Population Health Summit group recommended was start with your own employees. It's a double win for you in that regard, because if we get our own employees healthier, we're going to pay less premiums for their care. And it's a population, it's our staff. So it's actually, I'm going to say it's a triple win. We actually get to do something good for our staff. And then the third thing is it prepares us for this future where we're going to be reaching out to the whole community. So I kind of want to emphasize that as, I think, kind of an important recommendation coming out of this summit meeting to rural hospital leaders. You know, start with your own staff. Start, you know, in Union General Hospital's case, they've already reached out to the community. So you decide what's appropriate for you. But in essence, keeping people healthy is going to be a big part of our business of the future. And that's why we think this call is important. And we think the work that Union General has been doing is an important model for others as well. And then another piece that I want to talk about, and then throw this to both Pat and Evelyn, is community assessments. And one of the reasons, probably the best reason, that hospitals have been doing this is there's an IRS requirement for nonprofit hospitals to do a community assessment at least every 3 years. But I'd suggest that these community assessments are way more important than just to satisfy IRS requirements. That it is an opportunity to really touch base with the folks that live in your community to get their feedback of what they like and what they don't like, to get their projection of what type of services they're going to be interested in the future. You know, you can be developing wellness programs, but if they don't want them, then it's going to be like any other business that is a good idea, but that really doesn't have the base. So kind of finding out what people want and need become another really important piece. The third piece I think is often underappreciated, and that is that we have a significant, I'm talking the average hospital, but I'll give you an example. We have a lot of people leaving our local community to go elsewhere. And here at the center, we have been doing community assessments since 1987. We've done probably hundreds of them, I think, in that time period. And I can tell you, in virtually every single case, the population of these communities that they're all rural communities that we're assessing, the population doesn't know what the services are in the hospital. So if they need cardiac rehab, many cases they'll leave, even though it seems obvious to everyone in the hospital that cardiac rehab is one of the services that we have. In Tennessee, they did a study about 18 months ago, and they found out, they looked at every single rural hospital in Tennessee, and they concluded, this is one of these big research organizations, over 50% of the business that could have been coming to local hospital was leaving. On average, in all those hospitals, that's a huge out-migration. It's consistent with our experience over the years since 1987 as well. And so, Pat, you indicated that your network decided to do community assessments. Can you talk a little bit more about that and what you're seeing in terms of results?
Yeah, we employed somebody that had skills in doing community assessments, actually an attorney that did a lot of organizational work, and we felt that our hospitals would not get it done, and if we didn't have a program that we could provide where we could do focus groups and provide that and try to provide it at affordable cost. That's why we did it. We knew that there was a great need. We have a lot of non-for-profits in Illinois. Anyway, what we found is that it was interesting. What you would have thought would have been high priorities have really shifted, as I mentioned, wellness and mental health and things like that. And what was interesting is that the focus groups were very good. If we keyed in and brought people in. If you just did a blanket invitation to the community to add their comments, they didn't come in because they didn't feel that connected. So that's one thing I think hospitals have to figure out, how to connect with their group. The key stakeholders and others and that will come and participate with the community needs assessment. But, just doing a blanket thing, people are so busy with their lives. So if you want to get actual feeling and ideas from the community itself, you have to look at other ways of getting them involved. But, it was some neat ideas that people came up with. It was a way of bridging health departments together. That's a big focus of pulling together your health department and your hospital community and your provider community together. So that was really beneficial. And there's some neat programs that have started from the community needs assessment. So I think it's been a real plus. Most importantly, is getting the hospitals to implement, programs based on the needs assessment. And next year we start the second round of the community needs assessment for hospitals. It's a 3-year project. So, really a shift over the years, community health needs assessment into wellness, mental health, and other kinds of things from just having access to care. I think people believe there's access to care. Now they just want to maintain it.
Evelyn, what was the catalyst for you doing your community needs assessment originally?
Well, originally it was because it was a requirement. And we began that in the fall of 2011 and completed it by our physical year, June 12. We're developing an ongoing interest in helping our community make appropriate choices and decisions about their health and medical care to reduce unnecessary medical expenses, keep healthy, and specifically working on lifestyle changes through personal choices. In our plan, our target population includes people with labels such as indigent, elderly, or young people's lifestyles, employees, beneficiaries, citizens, and the consumers in our parish. It's very, very labor intense. And we began this process by appointing a coordinator, and that was Diane Davison. And I can tell you that she spent hundreds of hours on this detailed process, and it is very detailed. But through the RHPI grant, we were able to hire Drayfin and Tucker as our consultants. And as we were taking on the task of designing individual programs, Claudia Wade, our grant writer, she's also a Hispanic liaison for our community, was brought on board. And these two ladies began their due diligence, and we just designed a wonderful program. I would really prefer them to talk about that. They can give you more in-depth of what they've done. So, you know, they've just done a wonderful job, but I will tell you it's very labor intense.
Yeah.
Thanks.
To say the least, right?
Yes, exactly.
And I'm going to go there in just a minute. I'm going to have the other ladies kind of chime in here. Pat, as you're putting your larger program together, you know, as you've my understanding is you've applied to become Accountable Care Community. What sort of things? What were some of your challenges, and what are some of the things you've learned so far? If you wouldn't mind kind of summarizing them.
Well, it's really what you've been talking about is bringing everybody to the same level of education and getting your boards and your physicians engaged because they really didn't know and realizing that they're looking for an opportunity to participate. They felt that they would be better ahead than to do nothing at all. What we're learning is that many people aren't reporting their quality. A lot of the physicians are behind, and we're going to have to do a lot of education. There's a big gap in what people, you know, care transitions. People are still real siloed. You know, we say we're doing a lot of care management, but we're still real siloed from one level of care to the other. And that's where we feel that will be our biggest savings and challenge. In Illinois, we have 53 critical access, 51 and soon to be 53. And of them, there are 37 that are still independent. We've learned that hospitals don't know what to do, whether they should become part of a system or they better partnering with another hospital. And many of the boards still want to remain independent. And so that was one of the moves for shared savings. The hospitals realize that we've got to figure out ways that they can share some dollars, you know, share staff and things like that. So it's a real awakeness. They're starting to think, okay, how can I share some things? And many of them have not developed common platforms. We talk about patient-centered medical homes, but we really haven't gone to that. We know that there aren't really many disease registries. Some of the networks across the country have had grants for them and have done some great jobs, but we haven't really looked at those things, and so there'll be some exciting challenges. I anticipate about 20 to 25 of the hospitals out of 53 that will join the ACO, and we're submitting the application July 31st. We also looked out to our commercial carriers to see how as a group of us we could come together and purport to do all these care management and transition things in the without having an organized entity. The Blue Cross and Blue Shield and some of the others really didn't know what to do with us. We are going to participate in Blue Cross and Blue Shield. The state itself has an intensive medical home and has opened up those opportunities to participate in some of the programs that these folks have. So my advice and encouragement is see what your hospitals can do together as a group if they're not part of a system. If they are part of a system, start building on some of the ideas Evelyn and others have talked about. But for those that aren't, they really just are going to be left behind. And your boards and your medical staff are looking to the hospital for leadership. So that would be, you know, my advice. We hope to really build on those things and develop a wellness program and sharing a lot of ideas for that. So a lot of work ahead of us, but feel like we'll be better than we are. You know, what's the worst thing that happened? We learn from it and we move us one more notch.
Yeah, that's very well said, Pat. And we encourage hospitals, if you're not a part of a system, or even if you are, to look for those opportunities to work together. I've been very impressed with the Louisiana hospitals. In fact, I'm going to be working with them
as the Louisiana Critical Access Hospitals kind of get together and they start looking at, kind of what can we do together, what's coming down in terms of national and state policy, and how can we help each other kind of survive this very difficult time. We actually have termed it crossing the shaky bridge. So if you can picture this, you know, these big cliffs with a shaky bridge, swinging bridge between the two of them, that's kind of what rural hospitals are going to have to do, because they're getting paid one way, and that's the traditional way. But in essence, it's very clear to us that the new system is going to be very different, and we have to be cautious as we're moving across. But if we work together and if we maximize our efficiencies, we work with our community, we kind of enlist our physicians and other providers, we get our boards educated. You know, those are just some of the things that came out of our summit meeting, that in essence, there is a potentially bright future on that other side. I'm convinced personally that, you know, we're not all marching off to our doom here. Rural hospitals have a lot of advantages, and one of them is they're resourceful. They've been used to solving problems. They're more apt to work with their local providers, you know, other community resource people, which we're going to need to do, because we're going to have to work with the mental health providers. We're going to have to work with the long-term care providers, et cetera. And then we're able to do this at lower cost and with good quality and just basically with higher patient satisfaction. Remember, under the new formula, I guess I haven't said that yet, patient satisfaction will be financially rewarded and is already being rewarded for hospitals that are in our critical access. So with that, I'm going to now move into the kind of the last 20 minutes really talking about this project that took place at Union General. The consultant that was used was paid for by the Rural Hospital Performance Improvement Program, which, by the way, I should say, is funded by the Federal Office of Rural Health Policy, and I think we're in our 13th or 14th year of operation. But Cindy Dupree did this particular community assessment project. And so what I'd like to do is have our other folks, Diane and Claudia, talk a bit about, you know, what happened in the project. When did you meet Cindy? And if you could just kind of give me a little bit of a narrative of how the project went.
Well, this is Diane. I guess that's kind of where I started getting involved. We had a wonderful experience with the consultant. They gave us a blueprint, basically, of what we needed to do, an outline of what they expected. Kind of very scary at first because it was overwhelming, but we decided to eat the elephant one bite at a time. And before we get off track of it, I just wanted to say that all this kind of comes back to how do you do it, how do you implement it, how do you sustain it. It all comes with the CEO's buy-in, support, and direction. We've heard many CEOs state, "Oh, we'll put something together." You know, those people are not going to have a good outcome because they're not taking it seriously and they're not devoting their full resources and commitment. So that is important from the start. Basically, I don't want to spend too much time I want to be sure Claudia has time to tell about the program. That's one of the most proud programs we came up with out of it. But as it was said earlier, it had to come from people in the community that had direct invitations from us to come here and share their experiences. It could not be something we just put in the newspaper and hope somebody showed up. We specifically called and asked people to participate, gave them appointments, followed up with appointment cards. We had group community meetings, and we scheduled them with the particular people we wanted there, and we followed up reminders. And we had less than two or three not show up at any one meeting. And we did this over a course of a couple of weeks. And we were very focused on the organization part of it. And we had to do that. Nobody can do that for us. So that's how we got our community input. People were happy to help us, and they did not know every service we offered. So we learned things from them. They learned things from us. Part of that, after we found out we were already doing a lot of this stuff, it just was not being documented. It was not being captured. So we already had bits and pieces of the programs. We just had to formalize them, make people, you know, take the ownership of them. And along those lines, Evelyn made it clear to every director in this hospital that she expected participation and documentation from every department when they did something or offered a service or an education or supplied an employee, and they then had to report it. They report it to us every time a activity occurs, and we summarize it, you know, to capture all the information we need. And the program for It's a Girl Thing was one that we developed based on the need of the high STD and pregnancy population in our area that was higher than state and higher than national. We weren't doing anything that direction, so this idea was formulated, and Claudia took it and ran with it and found many community partners, and I think it's probably a good place for her to just tell about that program.
Hey, before I would really like to ask, this took a lot of courage, don't you think? I mean, hospitals don't traditionally get into an area as sensitive, particularly in the South, in terms of teen pregnancy and sexually transmitted disease. Evelyn, you want to chime in? Why did you decide to take on this project, and did you have any second thoughts about it in terms of what the community reaction might be?
Well, one thing was, I think everyone, including us, was shocked at the statistics that Drayson and Tucker researched and came up with in our community, how high the pregnancy and STD rate was, and smoking in teens. It was shocking to us and everybody here to not realize it had gotten that bad. So there was no really choice to do it. I think that was the most important factor that came out of it, is it affects everything from their education to, you know, what kind of a community we're going to live in if this is what's running rampant at this point. And you're right, it's one of those sensitive and touchy subjects that people don't usually go full blast at addressing.
Yeah, and I just want to applaud you for addressing it. I have a friend years ago, they were having problems because the teenagers in their community were driving to a distant community, and they'd had two wrecks where kids had been killed. And so the hospital decided it was going to put a movie theater into the community to support the community itself. And this was like another reminder of that, where you saw the need. You know, a lot of people could have said, that's not my problem. That's a public health problem. And so I really admire the courage that it takes to step in there, because public health resources are minimal, as you know, and hospitals are so much in a better position to help out with that, again, working with the public health. But that's what, you know, in my discussions, the when you ask the community, the community says the hospital should be involved in some of these sorts of community health issues. And so it's really great to see that you've been doing it. Talk a little bit about the program. So in essence, you did the community assessment. You identified, Drayson and Tucker helped you identify that there was a significant need here in this area. And so now, you know, tell us about what you did with that program, how you developed it, and kind of what the results so far.
This is Claudia Wade, and I am the coordinator for the program It's a Girl Thing, Making Proud Choices. And since teen pregnancy prevention and early education in schools were among the priorities identified by the CHNA Hospital Steering Committee, we decided to put a pregnancy and STD prevention program, and we started the program in the fall of 2013, and in less than a year, over 200 girls were enrolled. Nowadays, we have over 600 enrolled in the program. The mission of the program is to help change the views, circumstances, and life of teen girls. And our goals are to connect and educate with teen girls aged 12 to 17 with a focus on pregnancy and STD prevention while utilizing educational activities, health information, and comparable testimonials from influential community leaders. Information is provided to teens for use of tools to guide a process of understanding the importance of self-worth and setting goals in life. The objectives of the program are provide knowledge, enhance decision-making skills, change attitudes and beliefs about self-worth. And the learning outcomes we expect are the girls will be able to safely explore the consequences of their sexual health choices. They will be able to identify how sexual health choices made while they are teenagers can affect them for the rest of their lives. And they are being empowered by knowledge, with knowledge to make healthy choices. And we expect them to be able to analyze how their sexual health choices affect aspects of their overall health, considering physical, mental, emotional, social, and spiritual health. We have been talking about population health and the impact we have seen from engaging the community towards improving the population health through It's a Girl's Thing is that we are improving population health merely by educating in a supporting nature. The girls are being educated and informed on how to receive HPV vaccinations, perhaps. Many girls were not aware that they could or even needed to get the vaccinations. We are also being able to teach the girls about their menstrual cycles and delineate questions of normalcy and abnormal, therefore helping them receive medical care if indicated. We had a teen suffer from undiagnosed depression and had suicidal thoughts, and we had to refer her for counseling, and this teen had not come forward to her parents or educational support system. The intimate nature of exploring teen sexuality is at times forming a trust and a bond where they ask us questions in a confidential way. Teen health also is improving as it's clear to them the risk of STDs in pregnancy and how to avoid it. I would also like to share some of the topics we discussed in our meetings. Self-esteem, learning how to respect yourself and others, dating and violence. We talk about their reproductive system, sexual health, the consequences of teen pregnancies, sexually transmitted diseases, when pregnancy is going wrong, sexual abuse, how to be responsible, finances, etiquette, nutrition, drug prevention, bullying, dating violence, and many, many more subjects. We are also trying to teach them how to respect others and how to respect themselves. We meet with the girls once a month here at the hospital, and we also go to the schools every other week to meet with them during the whole morning. We are reaching 500 girls a month, more or less.
When Claudia first went to all of our schools in our parish, she did not meet any resistance. They welcomed her with open arms. In fact, the program has grown so much till other parishes have been contacting us about getting that program. So, you know, it's at a point in time that it's really not a taboo anymore. It's let's talk about it. Let's get it out. Let's educate. And I am very glad that the time has evolved like that.
How is it? You know, so this is just an absolutely wonderful program. So we're really proud of you for implementing it. But has it helped connect you closer to the community as a whole, to your service area?
This is Diane. I think it's really kicked off a lot of connection. Claudia has been amazing at pulling a network of other people in the community together. The library has picked up on it and offered some additional services over there where the girls were at a book club.
We have a book club and a movie night for them. We have extended our services to that point. And we have a great support not only from the library, but the local businesses, the newspapers, the school board, the Children's Coalition, and even the law enforcement agencies are being engaged.
The school superintendent here, after learning of the program and seeing what it was, actually he came here and said, we want you to do a program in the school for the ones that can't come after hours to a meeting at the hospital. So he mandated it for all the parish school systems to participate. So it was engaging the school, I think everybody, school system, local grocery stores, the health unit, I mean the LSU nutrition. There's hardly anybody been untouched that doesn't participate, donate, and get and sponsor. I mean, it just seems to get bigger as we go.
We're growing continually because we are also doing an anti-bullying program in the schools that partnered with the school system that tagged along with the girls program. So we are trying to do drug prevention. Targeting the fourth graders, fourth and fifth graders, going all the way to the teenage girls. And the benefit of partnering with other organizations has been the broad community resources and awareness. There are many facets of community and legal, healthcare, and educational resources benefited Union General Hospital by adding to our endeavors. Other than obvious input from the resources, we find we reach more young people utilizing partners.
And so in essence, let me just kind of repeat what I heard here, is starting out with this project, and Evelyn, I do understand this took time, and, you know, we have super busy people. I'm sure your hospital is just like all the other rural hospitals listening in on this, but in essence, this is an activity that involve the libraries, the schools, the businesses, et cetera. And I'm going to suggest that one of the best forms of marketing, when people think of marketing, they think, oh, they're going to put up a big billboard and they'll put an expensive, you know, advertisement or a commercial, et cetera. That's really not, you know, what rural hospitals can either afford. You know, they want to do articles, they want to do some things, et cetera. But to me, the most effective marketing we can do are these sorts of projects, because we're getting the library, the people in the library, we're getting the business engaged. And a lot of people take that hospital for granted unless they're sick or unless they get to the point where they absolutely need it in an emergency. Now you're seeing a new role emerging in this community with a hospital reaching out and talking, dealing with issues that are social issues as well as healthcare issues. Because one of the things we know is if you look at what are the factors that influence the healthcare of the people in our community, it's partially about having good hospitals, it's partially about having good healthcare providers and good equipment, et cetera. But a whole part of it has to do with kind of these social factors, and it has to do with poverty. It has to do with people's lifestyles, et cetera. And whether it's fair or not, I mean, part of the message we're trying to get across here is that we as a group of healthcare providers in the future are going to be responsible for the entire health of our community. And so this is such a really an excellent step forward. It has a huge impact. It's again, just I'm really glad we're able to talk about it today, because it's a on the ground example of what we think should very well be happening in mm-hmm. hospitals across the United States.
Yeah. I thank you for that kind word. If I was to say anything, I guess it's that do not be afraid to step out, because I think the time has evolved to where people do want to hear about this, even in the South. So do whatever you can to reach those young people.
And in essence, that's just not the right thing to do. That's become the good business thing to do as well. And again, I don't know if anybody on the line has a quick question. We have a couple of minutes left if they want to get it out. If they want to save it and send it in to Leslie, and we'll get it answered for you with our speakers or anything that we can do as well. Anybody, if you do hit star two, usually people don't like to talk in these calls, but I do want to give that opportunity if anybody wants to ask a question or make a comment. Okay, terrific. Then I really want to thank our speakers. I think it was a great example. First of all, we have, you know, the Illinois Critical Access Hospital Network that are taking that bold step across the shaky bridge. Scary.
It is scary.
But what I heard you say, Pat, is we're not charging across, you know, with our swords out, swinging. We're being cautious.
That's right. We're taking gradual steps.
And then at the hospital level, we have Union General Hospital that, again, is making its way out into this population health and discovering that, you know, they become a big part of helping to solve a huge community issue over and above what traditionally hospitals do. So I think those are really great examples, and we have now reached the end of our time frame. Again, I want to really thank Pat, Diane, Claudia, and Evelyn for being on this call. And do we have any other scheduled, Leslie, or any other follow-up?
We have another PMG call, and that's scheduled for August 15th, and the call topic is going to be a quality improvement panel of hospitals.
So it's going to be on
Friday, August 15th.
At what time?
Same time, 10 a.m.
10 a.m., and it's going to be on the whole issue of quality and quality improvement. So with that, thank you, everybody, for participating, and we will see you in a couple of weeks. Bye.
Thank you.
The organizer has disconnected, and this conference will continue for 60 minutes.